I'm not going to talk much about our lead law, actually, but what I want to focus on is the role of information in getting to that lead law outcome. And part of the reason for that is I think that in any area that you're working in, particularly if you're working at the local or state level, it's very important to get scientific information into the process. And I think that CBPR is often viewed as kind of a salvation and something that's going to improve the use of information in lots of different situations, but it's not always appropriate. So no relationships. I'm going to take on the somewhat politically incorrect position of saying when CBPR is not the answer, but yet you really want to be getting scientific information into a policy process. So whether you're in a government agency or in a not-for-profit or in academia, I'm hoping to draw out some lessons from what we did in Rochester that'll be relevant to you, particularly if you're working at the state or local level, where there aren't traditionally the kinds of resources of science advisory boards and national organizations that are there in place to ensure that decisions are made based on the best available science. I started thinking about this process in terms of how did we get information into a local lead law process when I was doing interviews for a different paper about our lead law, and one former city council member told me this was the first time that we in city council realized that there was a non-governmental group that knew much more about this than our staff did. And it started, for the first time, us looking outside city government for information. And it was very surprising to them that they themselves, the city government, wasn't the technical experts, that lead was such a diverse area that there was no way that their staff could get up to speed and provide appropriate advice. And yet there was this community organization that was providing that level of advice. And it was very surprising to them. But one of the most exciting things to me was that he said, "This changed the way we do business in City Council, and now, starting with this case of lead, we look more to the outside to try to partner to make sure that our local decisions are the best they can be." So that's the context for why I want to share this story with you, and even if you don't care about lead at all, I hope there'll be some lessons that are relevant for you. So I'm going to start by just briefly going over the conceptual framework for information and power in issues of environmental justice. And then talk a little bit about a concept that I developed to explain how we manage this called boundary networks. And I'll give you just enough background about the Rochester Coalition to Prevent Lead Poisoning so you can understand the case material and go through how information was incorporated at each stage of the policy process. And then try to say, so what? You know, what might this mean to you in whatever issue you're interested in? So in general, it's accepted that environmental justice communities, almost by definition of being disempowered and disproportionately burdened, lack technical resources. And that's part of the reason they got to be EJ communities, is they didn't have the economic and technical expertise to be able to stand up to the kinds of industrial forces that were contaminating the communities. And therefore, they're disadvantaged in the policy process. And the idea of CBPR is that knowledge is power, and that if you can work together to empower communities with information, that's going to make it more possible for them to have a positive role in the policy process. So as I said, CBPR is really a catchphrase that we use in lots of circumstances, but it really talks about a fairly narrow set of circumstances, and there are many, many other cases where I would argue CBPR is not possible and maybe not desirable. Okay, so think about what do you really need for CBPR? You need a really clearly defined problem. So Dr. Stone's example was a very clear one. There was a consensus around a problem of PAHs where more information was needed by a community, also well identified, and they had some specific questions. Do our traditional practices of smoking put us at risk? You need researchers who are able to offer something that can answer those questions, and you need resources for collaboration, some sort of institutional framework that allows the researchers in the community to work together, technical resources to support that research, and financial to be able to make that possible. And in his example, that was the advisory board that they put together and the grant funding that OSU had obtained. Now let's think about what's needed for a policy process. Okay, his example wasn't looking at policy, but if you were to be thinking about maybe a decision was being made at a local level, It's important to recognize that policy is a process, not an outcome. So a lot of times people talk about policy as, here's a law, we're going to analyze its impacts, or we're going, you know, either before or after. But it starts by how the issue is framed. And framing is a much more complex process than people often give it credit for, that depending on how you frame an issue, a different policy approach is going to be taken. So, for the lead example, historically that's been looked at as an issue of health. So the secondary prevention strategies of screening children for lead and then trying to remove the sources of lead in their environment is appropriate. But if you redefine it as an issue of housing, it's a totally different set of policy strategies, information that you need, and actors. So after an issue is framed, then there's the process of selecting solutions. Usually a variety of alternatives are considered. Picking one and then promoting it, and then once that it's in place, it's very important to evaluate the implementation, because of course implementation of a law doesn't always happen the way its designers envision. And depending on that evaluation, either terminating it or reframing the question to go back to the beginning. So CBPR within a process like that is very challenging, because you may not know what the question is at the outset. There may, in fact, be multiple questions, and instead of having one researcher paired up with that one question, you may need multiple disciplines. One university may not even have all of those disciplines at their disposal, never mind within one research group or department. Generally, for policy purposes, you're looking at applying what is already known rather than generating new knowledge. And there's the question of who hosts and sustains that collaboration, taints that knowledge with what position that group takes. So it's very different if information is brought to the table by the health department versus a community group versus a university. And each of those has different levels of credibility with different audiences. So one way that I'm a policy scientist, and one way that policy scientists have thought about this is an area called boundary work. So looking specifically at that area between science and policy and where in that spectrum a question lies. And what policy scientists have found, and is kind of common sense, is that often in a policy debate, there are individuals who are spanning boundaries. So perhaps the one individual in the health department who is reaching out to community groups and willing to work with them, or maybe one or two particular researchers the same way, or a few community groups that are willing to trust the establishment or the government and work together. Those are boundary-spanning individuals who are willing to go back and forth between the arena of values and policy and of technical information and science. And in some areas, there are whole organizations devoted to this at the national level or international level. And one of the most this term originated was the scientific organizations that are in place strictly for informing policy decisions around water quality in the Mediterranean. And you might think of the IPCC as a boundary organization that's not necessarily to generate new information, but to pull it together in a way that informs the policy process. You don't have an IPCC for local lead laws, right? There aren't boundary organizations generally at local or even state levels. So what I realized is when I was thinking about how did we managed to tap into so much information in this case that we had an informal boundary network. So there were individuals that were involved in the process at at different levels, came from a lot of different organizations. And what I'd like to share with you now is a little bit several examples of how that happened to help you think about how that might be relevant to the cases you're interested in. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about the coalition, then the process of getting to our lead law, and then about how to foster the boundary networks like we had. So when I talk about lead, I often get the reaction of, but why are you still talking about lead? Didn't we solve that problem back in the 70s when we banned lead from paint and it was phased out of gasoline? And if you look at the statistics, the lead levels in the population have plummeted. But, and that's why it's thought of as one of our major environmental public health successes. And yet, lead levels remain high in certain populations, particularly minority and low-income populations living in older housing. And that's why I think of it as an environmental justice crisis despite being a public health success. And that's difficult to get beyond that paradigm when you're trying to get people interested and excited in this issue when they think it's already gone and over. This is what lead poisoning looks like in Rochester. So the typical peeling paint, deterioration, particularly around windows and impact surfaces, and bare soil. because we have long winters, and it's very difficult to maintain nice green grass, so we have a lot of bare soil in yards. So when I first moved to Rochester around 2001, I went to a community forum that was hosted by the department I later joined, and found that in the state of New York had high levels of children with elevated blood lead levels, and our county had even higher levels, and within certain high-risk neighborhoods in the city of Rochester, they were over 10 times the national level. So that was a pretty clear problem. And so then in some neighborhoods, they were even above 30%. Meanwhile, some very key research was going on at the University of Rochester that was part of the growing body of knowledge showing that lead was more dangerous at lower levels than we had ever previously believed. So this was a partnership between some researchers at the University of Rochester and elsewhere that was really influential in how we think about lead, and particularly highlighting that children's ability to learn to read was influenced by very low levels of lead. And because this research was happening locally, so here we're getting to the boundary network, the principal of one of the schools that was in a high-risk area did a study with the director of the health department and found that 41% of his incoming kids had elevated blood lead level. And he also had noticed that all of his special ed kids had EBLs. And so he sort of put two and two together, this research that was being highlighted in our local news because it happened to be done locally, and the fact that his kids couldn't learn to read, and hosted a community forum that brought together researchers, doctors, and housing experts, who then formed the Coalition to Prevent Lead Poisoning. So this is how the issue became framed in Rochester as an issue of children's health, and that it was really critical because of educational outcomes. And we have a 40% graduation rate in the city of Rochester. So the fact that it was reframed from something that the health department took care of as a secondary prevention thing to a problem that is a contributor to our crisis of education in the state, in the city, was a very different framing. So out of this meeting, there was a coalition formed. I just want to point out that this was a very low budget operation. It never had more than 2.5 staff for most of its existence, only about one FTE. But what it had is 7 volunteer working committees that had experts in many different disciplines, and if they didn't know the answer to something, they knew somebody who did. And so the staff was not used to generate new information, it wasn't used for technical purposes, it was basically used to support these working committees. And an important decision that they made early on was that all of their decisions would be based on the best available science. And they were focused on, you know, preventing kids from getting lead poisoned. So at this stage, the actors that I've highlighted in the boundary network were the U of R researchers, local healthcare providers, the elementary school educators, local housing programs, and our health department. Now the next stage involved, and so we've got this problem defined, what are we going to do about it? Again, you can see this isn't a problem where you could go to one single researcher and say, let's do some CBPR and we'll solve the problem. We really need to think about a comprehensive solution that depended on a lot of different kinds of information. The main concern of the whole community was the cost, and for that reason, when we were looking for different approaches, we focused in on geographic targeting and finding cost-effective solutions. And for this, we looked at national experience from communities like Chicago and Providence and places where people had mapped out lead poisoning and found that it's constrained. You can define very narrow neighborhoods where it was a big problem, and that in general, if you look at the national housing research, rentals are riskier. So that national, being able to tap into that national research helped us focus on strategies very quickly that were going to be targeted at the highest risk housing. At the same time, the county had a little extra money, and they funded a county needs assessment that made maps of where that high risk housing was. And then also we did some analyses of the state health department data that just showed where the highest rates of lead poisoning were. So this is statewide. It's kind of shocking finding that 40% of the lead poisoning cases happen in only 22 of the zip codes statewide. And this helped the coalition frame the geographic targeting, but also the racial targeting of this, why this is a problem. And that became important for organizing. So certain communities realized that, hey, this is our problem because our children are disproportionately affected by it. And so it wasn't a new study. It was just a simple analysis of data that was out there that hadn't been sliced by race before. And when the statistics showed that 33% of black children, 12% of all Latino children, and only 4% of all white non-Hispanic children lived in one of those 22 high-risk zip codes, it really reframed the issue in terms of a political and community organizing strategy. And this is the map of risk of lead in Rochester. The other focus was on finding cost-effective controls, and there it was necessary to delve into national data on that was coming out about the effectiveness of interim controls. That was largely research based on HUD programs, also interpreting local data that had been accumulated in the course of HUD grants and some community programs to look at lead risks. Again, this is not funding a new study in the mode of CBPR, but rather taking existing information that was out there and slicing it in a different way that led the coalition to focus on interim controls and targeting and monitoring them and focusing them on high-risk areas. So these are some of the organizations that were involved at that step, a different cast of characters. The next step was in promoting the policy solution. And since I'm almost out of time, I'm not going to give you a lot of examples, but one that was very helpful and sort of surprising to me was the lead cost calculator. It was the first thing the coalition ever asked me to do. And I'm a policy scientist, but they said, we need somebody who can pull together the costs of lead poisoning to our community. And there's lots of information out there about how lead affects IQ and therefore reduces earning potential later in life. Well, local government doesn't care about that because what they care about is their budget year to year. So what I did was to pull out of the medical literature and housing literature and education literature, different sources of estimating what the financial costs year by year were in terms of medical costs, education, special education, and criminal justice. Now, this was a really rough analysis, and I never even published it because I could never get the data to be up to date enough to feel like any journal would want to see it. And the estimates were so rough that I didn't think that they were actually doing a good job of reflecting the costs. But this was incredibly influential in the policy process. And somebody still calls me every 4 months or so to ask me, how did you do this? Can we apply it in our community? And the Alliance for Healthy Housing put it up on their website as a cost calculator that people used all over the country. Again, nothing that I could have ever gotten funded as a researcher to do, but something that was very valuable both to our policy debate and communities throughout the country. So I'm going to skip over the other examples here in the interest of time and point out that I am in a community outreach and education program of an NIEHS-funded center. And as such, I have a little bit of flexible time that enables me to do that. Nobody else really had the time or excuse to do that. If I had been in a position of having to get outside funding before I could even have done that, it wouldn't have happened. So I just wanted to highlight that, and the National Center for Healthy Housing, which similarly has the ability to respond in some very practical, applied ways to taking national data and crunching it, applying it to different cases. Those were both incredibly useful resources, even though they weren't large in terms of dollar value. Similarly, we are continuing to evaluate the lead law. Local governments very seldom have resources for evaluation, but because this is a new innovation, it's critical that we learn whether it's effective or not. And city government, county government are constantly being cut. They can generate some data, you know, they have inspection records, but they don't have the capacity to pull it together and say, so what? You know, is our lead law working? What are some of the alterations that this data might be suggesting? And this is a very active area right now as the city budget is being cut very severely. Throughout this process, you know, this lead law has contributed to a significant decline in lead poisoning from there were about 1,200 kids a year when I moved to town in 2000, and we're down to 283 this year. And we can't say it's just that lead law, but the overall process of community organizing added to the trend of a downward trend anyway has seemed to have made a big difference. And I just wanted to highlight these are the members of the boundary network that took place at the evaluation level. I just want to highlight a couple of things that were said to me when I was looking back at this process and asking, how did we manage to get so much good information into this process when we had nothing to work with? And one person, after I interviewed them about this, says, well, you know, I guess it really is worth the time and effort to recruit experts. And part of recruiting them is convincing them that it will make a difference. So some of the lessons that we learned from this is that it's very important to develop relationships with a wide variety of experts. And that really was a focus of the staff of the coalition. They weren't doing the research, they were developing relationships and sort of triaging what questions were important and who would be able to answer them, asking appropriate things. So not asking a researcher in economics to, say, do a policy analysis or vice versa, or asking a doctor to write a letter, an editorial, but to edit something that they had written and submit that. Giving credit where credit is due and also being willing to ask for help at the local, regional, and national level. So just skipping to the end, I really think this idea of a boundary network can be very helpful in terms of making sure that good information gets into a policy process even when you don't have dedicated resources to do science. That coalition building has to include the interests of technical experts as well. And CBR is just one tool in terms of a larger policy process. I guess I'd like to sum it up by saying the one thing that the coalition got really early on is that technical experts, scientists, healthcare providers, lawyers are people too. And that they need to be incorporated in, you know, the same way you think about organizing a community, you need to think of the same way in terms of organizing experts. What are their incentives? What matters to them? What can they do? And what do they appreciate? I think that the coalition's starting by saying every position we make is going to be science-based made them feel very safe, and the fact that their work was, they were asked appropriate things and then given lots of credit and thanks for participating in this process helped keep them involved. The same principles you'd use with organizing a community. So I hope that's helpful to you in your work, and I'd be happy to take a question or two.
One hand up for sure. Let me start.
I am in a state where we're struggling with getting a sense of what the problem with lead is because our screening is so low. And I'm wondering how much the already established New York, from what I know, New York has a fairly high level of screening, and how much the sort of the established data that you have allow for this project to be successful. And I guess in particular, the needs assessment, and was that based on screening tests that were already there, or did they use that local money and actually go out and choose?
And they used existing screening data, but that really wasn't the big part of it. The biggest part of that needs assessment was to go to the national literature that said kids will be poisoned in old rental housing, low-income housing, and map out those risk factors and say, here's the high-risk housing. There are plenty of scientific studies out there that link high-risk housing and blood lead level. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. Now, that said, it was really useful to have a few small local cases to say, guess what? Rochester isn't different than the rest of the world. And that sort of strengthened the link to that national analysis. So that's a really good example of where I said you don't have to do new research, you don't even need local data, but if you slice the available national studies out there and apply them to your community, it's really the same. High-risk housing equals poisoned children, and unless it's a different planet, that relationship is going to be there. So I say that not having the screening data is not an excuse, and in fact, for most of this time, I fought tooth and nail about emphasizing increasing screening rates because I said, you know, I don't really care what their blood lead levels are, I know what they'll be. Let's focus on solving the problem.